Ready to pop the question? The jewelers at BlueNile.com have got sparkle down to a science with beautiful lab-grown diamonds worthy of your most brilliant moments. Their lab-grown diamonds are independently graded and guaranteed identical to natural diamonds, and they're ready to ship to your door. Go to BlueNile.com and use promo code LISTEN to get $50 off your purchase of $500 or more. That's code LISTEN at BlueNile.com for $50 off. BlueNile.com, code LISTEN.
Hey, it's Danny Pellegrino from Everything Iconic. Ready to upgrade your style game without blowing your budget? Check out Quince. They've got all the good stuff, shirts and polos, activewear and fine leather goods, all at 50 to 80% less than other high-end brands. And the best part? They're all about safe, ethical, and responsible manufacturing. Get that luxury vibe without the luxury price tag. Hit up quince.com/upgrade for free shipping and 365-day returns on your next order. That's quince.com/upgrade.
I'm David Knowles, and this is Ukraine, the latest. Today, we discuss the heavy fighting in the east as Russia approaches Chasiv Yar. We report on the inauguration of Vladimir Putin in Moscow, and we analyse Ukraine's manpower crisis.
Bravery takes you through the most unimaginable hardships to finally reward you with victory.
If we give President Zelensky the tools, the Ukrainians will finish the job. Slava Ukraini!
Nobody's gonna break us. We're strong. We're Ukrainians.
Every weekday afternoon, we sit down with leading journalists from the Telegraph's London newsroom and our teams reporting on the ground to bring you the latest news and analysis on the war in Ukraine. It's Tuesday, the 7th of May, 2 years and 74 days since the full-scale invasion began. And today, I'm joined by our associate editor Dominic Nichols, assistant comment editor Francis Dernley, and our guest is French foreign correspondent based in Kiev, Fabrice Desprez. I started by asking Dom for the latest news from Ukraine.
Well, hi, everybody. So, over the weekend, Russia launched drones and missiles across Ukraine. People packed churches to celebrate the Orthodox Easter, causing death and destruction and injuries across, mostly in the east of the country. On Saturday evening, Ukraine's Air Force said it had shot down 23 of 24 Russian drones fired at Kharkiv, Kherson, and Dnipropetrovsk regions. Earlier that day, President Zelensky said that Ukraine had shot down another Russian fighter jet. Now, Orthodox Christians in both Ukraine and Russia were celebrating Easter this weekend when the strikes hit various towns and cities across the country. Ihor Terekov, who's mayor of Kharkiv, said a missile hit the central part of the city in the residential area. We know an attack is considered highly likely in the Kharkiv region, that's up in the northeast. But the main fight right now, with strikes across the weekend, was happening a little bit further to the south. So grab your maps, everybody. So we're still in the far east of the country, but about 200 kilometers southeast of Kharkiv. So in this area in the east, basically Russia is pushing on two axes of advance at the moment. So if you picture Bakhmut and 50 kilometers to the south of Bakhmut, Donetsk City. So the northern axis goes west and southwest of Bakhmut, aiming to go through the town of Chasiv Yar. The southern axis is going west and northwest of Donetsk City through Avdiivka, Osheretytynia, and up to where we see them now with that salient that's been developed over the last couple of weeks. Now, Russia would hope to link up both of these arms. I think that is a little bit beyond them right now. They are still at about 40 k's apart at the furthest extent, and they are extended. They've both been sort of advances through where they found gaps in the line, in the Ukrainian line, and hence they are very vulnerable. Their flanks are vulnerable, but there are two arms, if you like, that Russia would hope to join up. So on the Donetsk axis, down in the south, on Sunday, Russia's MOD said it had captured the town of Osheretynia. So this is about 15 k's northwest of Avdiivka. Ukraine's military has acknowledged the Russians have gained what they call is a foothold. They say is a foothold in the village, which had about 3,000 people, a population of, before the war. Ukraine's MOD says that fighting is continuing in the town there, though. Then 20 k's west of there, Vadim Filashkin, that's Ukraine's governor of Donetsk, said that rocket attacks had killed people in Pokrovsk. So 20 k's west of the end of that southern arm, about 40 k's northwest of Donetsk city itself. Western analysts I've been reading are saying that the attempt to capture Tetyna is part of Russia's efforts to consolidate control along that advance in the south. They dispute the strategic significance of that town. They say the more important one is Chasiv Yar. That's on the northern axis I mentioned a little while ago. That's on high ground. It defends a handful of other cities in the valleys below, such as Konstantinivka, Kramatorsk and Slovyansk, which Ukrainian forces continue to defend. However, disagreeing with that analysis, that it's the southern axis that's most important, General Sursky, who's the Ukraine's commander-in-chief, he said Russia is trying to break through defences west of Donetsk city to reach Kurukove and Pokrovsk, the town where I just mentioned the rockets killed civilians over the weekend. However, he said he'd spent 2 days down there working with units deployed in Ukraine's east in that area, which he said is Russia's main attack direction. Now, he said the main enemy's attack forces are concentrated here with attempts to break through the defence of our troops and, after building on their success, reach the towns of Kurukove and Pokrovsk. He said he'd met with brigade commanders and other officers and made all the necessary decisions to strengthen the defence with reserves, to allocate additional missiles, ammunition, electronic warfare equipment and unmanned aerial vehicles. Our task in these conditions is to hold frontiers and positions, to inflict maximum losses on the enemy, to exhaust them, thereby disrupting the enemy's plans and gaining time to form and prepare our defences. I note his comment there, they're working to inflict maximum losses on the enemy and to exhaust them. I mean, there comes a point where you have no troops left. Obviously, it could do if you are militarily defeated. But a lot of war is about relative strengths. And at the moment, it seems the ground that Russia is taking is coming at a huge, huge cost. And on that, Britain's MOD over the weekend said that Russia's army has now suffered 465,000 casualties, dead, injured, taken prisoner and missing in action. They said, however, Russia could absorb that high casualty rate amid the Kremlin's plans to reorientate society and the economy to feed the war machine. In a daily security briefing over the weekend, they said, despite the extreme cost in life, Russia has fully adapted its military to attritional warfare, which relies on mass over quality. Ukrainian generals have briefed that the situation along the front line is dire, but Jake Sullivan, US National Security Advisor, speaking to the Financial Times, said Ukraine will be able to hold off Russian attacks with the resupply of weapons that went through with the recent supplemental. So we think the analysis at the moment is that the cost to Russia in lives are being regenerated by the sort of quasi-mobilization, albeit they're not gaining numbers, they're just not going down, basically. And MOD here in UK say that the April average daily casualty toll for Russia was 899 people a day. 899 a day. Staggering. Okay, next. Russia has warned that it could target British military sites as it announced snap nuclear weapons drills in response to the so-called provocative comments by Lord Cameron, our Foreign Secretary, and Emmanuel Macron, President of France. Moscow's Foreign Ministry summoned the British ambassador yesterday to protest Lord Cameron's backing for Kyiv to fire British-made weapons into Russia. In a statement, the Russian Foreign Ministry said, an answer to a Ukrainian strike on Russia using British weapons would be made against any British military facilities or equipment in Ukraine and beyond. France's ambassador was also summoned in Moscow and summoned to the ministry for a complaint about comments President Macron had made when he said that, or hinted that French soldiers could be sent to Ukraine. So far, so normal. However, Dmitry Peskov, Kremlin spokesman, said that striking Russia with NATO missiles or NATO-supplied missiles or deploying NATO forces to Ukraine were red lines that should not be crossed. Continuing the Russian theme of always going for the most extreme, the blood and thunder interpretation, Peskov said they were talking about being prepared and even intending to send armed deployments to Ukraine, which is essentially putting NATO soldiers against the Russian military-ish. Again, he's making the most of it there. However, and noting that this comes from TASS, Russia's state news agency, Peskov's also reported as saying, deploying NATO soldiers to confront the Russian military in the latest escalation of tensions is an unprecedented move, and of course, it requires special attention and special measures. The term special measures there is often interpreted to be a hint at nuclear weapons. So rattling the nuclear saber again, which we shouldn't take lightly, but equally we need to just put it in the context of how they always say this stuff. So Putin has recently ordered his army to simulate the use of tactical nuclear weapons over these so-called threats from Britain and France. Russian Defense Ministry has told its southern military district, that's the one bordering eastern Ukraine, to hold tactical nuclear weapon drills, quote, to practice the preparation and use of non-strategic nuclear weapons. The Russian MOD said, we hope that this event will cool down the hotheads in Western capitals, and said that these rocket, naval and aviation drills would begin soon. Now, a lot of Russian battlefield weapons are dual use, so they can be nuclear, can fire nuclear shells, can fire conventional shells. So often these drills, you don't know what they're practicing for. It's only because they've announced that this is nuclear stuff that we go, oh wow, they're, you know, it's practicing nuclear. So we just need to put it into context. But of course, it's always a little concerning when this kind of chat gets out into the open. Ukraine's military spy agency spokesperson Andrei Yusov, speaking on national TV, said, we do not see here anything new. Nuclear blackmail is a constant practice of Putin's regime. But analysts said that Russia announcing the drill specifically in response to Western statements did mark a fresh development in nuclear signalling. Now, William Albuquerque, the former director of NATO Arms Control, Disarmament and Non-Proliferation Centre, is also a fellow at the IISS, International Institute for Strategic Studies, someone we've spoken to before on the pod. He said, my impression is that this is a clear attempt to use nuclear coercion against Macron himself for his recent statements on Ukraine and Russia. We are certainly embarking on unknown territory in terms of nuclear signalling. So it is concerning, but like I say, we've got to put it in context. Russia's military doctrine, you'll remember, does allow it to use tactical nuclear weapons on battlefields. It's you know, at a much lower threshold than Western counterparts, or Western adversaries, I should say. They've obviously previously threatened to fire them at Ukrainian forces in the Donbass, but the Kremlin has not actually tested a nuclear warhead since 1990 and is a signatory to the 1996 Comprehensive Test Ban Treaty, which bans all such nuclear tests. Even so, the Kremlin regularly makes a show of testing missile systems capable of carrying a nuclear warhead, but as I say, many of them are also conventional capable. Last year, I think we reported at the time, Sergei Karaganov, who's chairman of Russia's influential Council for Foreign and Defence Policy think tank, he said that tactical nuclear weapons should be used in Donbass to blunt a NATO-backed Ukrainian offensive, and what he said was lower the threshold for the use of nuclear weapons. Now, he is a bit like Medvedev, he's allowed to go and say these things. Putin doesn't necessarily back them up, but they like having these ideas out there. We should say Andrew Poklitsky, who's a senior researcher at the UN's Institute for Disarmament Research, said that it was likely Russia's planning to test tactical weapon systems rather than actually firing any missiles that may or may not be nuclear compatible. However, he did say, even so, this is definitely nuclear signalling, and what is quite surprising is how clear this is. Normally, countries don't say specifically why they are exercising their nuclear forces. As we know, Russia has been ramping up the nuclear tension over the last 2 years as their war has been going, you know, from bad to worse. And we know that Russia has sent nuclear missiles to Belarus for the first time since the end of the Cold War. So, yeah, concerning, but context. Concerning and context. Next one, David. A couple more for me. The Netherlands plans to start delivering F-16 fighter jets to Ukraine this autumn. Denmark say they'll be doing the same in the summer. This comes from Dutch Defence Minister Kaya Ollengren, speaking during a press conference in Vilnius yesterday. The Netherlands, will remember, has pledged 24 jets. I haven't got the exact number. I can't remember how many Denmark, Norway and Belgium have promised. But Denmark, the Netherlands and the US are leading this coalition established last year on the F-16 side of life. And then just finally for me, the gap between Ukrainian defence companies' production capacities and the funding they've received has got a figure of $10 billion, big B billion, US dollars put on it for this year. That comes from Oleksandr Kamyshin, Strategic Industries Minister, who was speaking yesterday at the EU-Ukraine Defence Industries Forum in Brussels. This is a big old meeting, 350 representatives from the EU, European and Ukrainian defence industries. They all meet to talk about the defence industrial base. Ukraine's Strategic Industries Ministry says that they could launch production of around $20 billion worth a year. I mean, you know, the devil will be in the detail. But at the moment has money only, pledges only of about $10 billion. So spare capacity and an attempt to build up Ukraine's sovereign defence industrial base. But I'd better take a little pause there, David.
Well, thank you very much, Dom, for catching us up with everything over the long weekend here in the UK. So thank you for that. Francis Sternley, can I turn to you? I know, again, this is going to be a bit of a catch-up of all the political and diplomatic developments. So let's start in Russia. It's been a big day in Russian politics. Francis Sternley.
Well, thanks, David. It certainly has. This morning, the political theatre of Putin's inauguration took place at the Kremlin, where he took the oath of office and was sworn in as Russia's president for a new six-year term, which means he would theoretically lead Russia until 2030. Were he to reach that milestone, he would be the longest Russian leader since Catherine the Great. You, citizens of Russia, have confirmed the correctness of the country's path. This is of great importance right now when we are faced with serious challenges, Putin remarked, blaming the West in his speech for the conflict in which his country now finds itself, but defiantly proclaiming that together Russia will win. Steve Rosenberg of the BBC was there and describes the atmosphere. The red carpet route may have been familiar to him, he writes, but much has changed since Putin's first inauguration ceremony in May 2000. Back then, Putin pledged to preserve and develop democracy and to take care of Russia. 24 years on, the Kremlin leader is waging war against Ukraine, a war in which Russia has suffered heavy losses. At home, instead of developing democracy, Putin has been curtailing it, jailing critics, removing all checks and balances on his power. He then quotes from Fiona Hill, the former White House National Security Advisor, quote, if we took ourselves back to his first two presidential terms, I think we'd have a fairly favourable assessment of Putin. He stabilised the country politically and made it solvent. The economy and system were performing better than at any previous time in its history. The war in Ukraine, going back to the annexation of Crimea 10 years ago, has dramatically changed that trajectory. He's turned himself into an imperialist instead of a pragmatist, Hill says. Now, it will be for historians to judge the degree of genuine transformation that occurred in Putin's political philosophy over those years versus the degree of conscious deception, saying what was required to ensure Putin kept the West broadly on side until he no longer needed it and can pursue his own path. Comparisons are sometimes made between Putinism and Stalinism as an ideology, and it is ironic that Stalin too oversaw a cultural revolution which rejected some of the modernism of the 1920s promoted by Lenin and sought to restore more traditional values to the country. That reached fever pitch following the German invasion of 1941. For those interested, the historian Orlando Figes wrote an excellent book which includes extensive discussion on this period. It's called Natasha's Dance, a vital reference text to the cultural history of Russia. Now, on the subject of the political cultural changes that have taken place in Russia since the full-scale invasion of Ukraine, the Washington Post has produced an excellent and important long read headlined Under Putin, a Militarized New Russia Rises to Challenge the US and the West. It is, David, the best summation of the revolution that has taken place over the past 2 years that I've read so far in this entire war. To quote the piece, Putin is positioning Russia as America's most dangerous and aggressive enemy and transforming his country in ways that stand to make it a bitter adversary of the West for decades to come. Over more than 6 months, the Post examined the profound changes sweeping Russia as Putin has used his war in Ukraine to cement his authoritarian grip on power. As Putin persists in his bloody campaign to conquer Ukraine, the Russian leader is directing an equally momentous transformation at home, re-engineering his country into a regressive, militarized society that views the West as its mortal enemy. Putin's inauguration will showcase Russia's shift into what pro-Kremlin commentators call a revolutionary power, set on upending the global order, making its own rules, and demanding the totalitarian autocracy he respected as a legitimate alternative to democracy in a world redivided by big powers into spheres of influence. The Post then lists the methods being deployed to carry out this transformation. 1. Forging an ultra-conservative, puritanical society mobilised against liberal freedoms, in which family policy and social welfare spending boost traditional, orthodox values. 2. Reshaping education at all levels to indoctrinate a new generation of turbo-patriot youth, with textbooks rewritten to reflect Kremlin propaganda, patriotic curriculum set by the state, and compulsory military lessons taught by soldiers. 3. Sterilising cultural life with blacklists of liberal anti-war performers, directors, writers and artists, and with new nationalistic mandates for museums and filmmakers. 4. Mobilising zealous pro-war activism under the brutal Z symbol, which was initially painted on the side of Russian tanks invading Ukraine, but has since spread to government buildings, posters, schools and orchestrated demonstrations. 5. Rolling back women's rights with a torrent of propaganda about the need to give birth, young and often, and by curbing ease of access to abortions and charging feminist activists and liberal female journalists with terrorism, extremism, discrediting the military and other offences. 6. Rewriting history to celebrate Stalin through at least 95 of the 110 monuments in Russia erected during Putin's time as leader. Meanwhile, Memorial, that human rights group that exposed Stalin's crimes and shared the Nobel Peace Prize, was shut down and its co-chairman jailed. 7. Accusing scientists of treason, equating criticism of the war or of Putin with terrorism or extremism, and building a new militarised elite of warriors and workers willing to take up arms, redraw international boundaries and violate global norms on orders of Russia's strongman ruler. I'll add a link, David, in the description to this piece, which includes an excellent map of those countries Moscow views as its allies or foes. As Dom said earlier, Moscow's reaction to the remarks of Lord Cameron and Emmanuel Macron last week is fascinating. And I find it incredibly revealing, actually, clearly giving the nature of this reaction, the use of Western weapons being increasingly used on Russian soil, striking its depots, etc., is a huge concern for Moscow. Otherwise, they wouldn't be reacting in this way. They want to nip it in the bud and are willing to do anything, as they always do, in order to try and deter it as soon as possible. I would suggest that is as revealing as to potential of those strikes as it is to the systemic anxiety and paranoia within Russian society of what would happen if the West does go further in its support of Ukraine.
Thank you very much, Francis, for that. Just a couple more developments then, if you could cover for us before we turn to Fabrice. Francis Durney.
Thanks. Just one major one, really, which is that last week, of course, we had our Berlin correspondent James Rothwell on the pod, giving us an update from Germany, including discussions of recent incidents involving Russian spycraft, not statescraft, spycraft. Well, today we have an update on those Taurus leaks, which caused such a scandal several weeks ago. An investigation by Die Zeit newspaper has found that details of over 6,000 past and future meetings were accessible on the internet, including the subject matter of the meetings and the names of its participants. Whilst it's thought hackers had access to actual lists of participants, they did not have the recordings of those discussions. But nonetheless, it is a major security flaw, and it's been found in the video conferencing software WebEx, with information being hosted on internal Bundeswehr servers. The URL links to the conferences included a simple series of consecutive numbers, which would have been easily guessable by hackers. Among the meetings that were at risk were ones labelled sensitive. They included discussions on Taurus cruise missiles and on the digital battlefield. The findings by Die Zeit also detailed that would-be hackers would have been able to access online meetings involving Olaf Scholz, with some involving top Luftwaffe General Gerhardt's accessible without a password. It's one of those that was recently leaked by pro-Kremlin social media in March. In it, listeners will recall, Gerhardt was heard discussing a strike on the Kerch Bridge between the occupied Crimea Peninsula and mainland Russia. Its leak was a huge embarrassment to Berlin. Now, responding to this report, Konstantin von Notz, the chairman of the Bundestag's Parliamentary Oversight Committee, said the Defence Ministry had a serious problem with security. Quote, "It's once again clear that in the face of new daily hybrid attacks, we need to actually implement the Zeitenwende." He was speaking to The Telegraph too last week and said that before the security weaknesses were public, Germany faces almost daily destabilisation attempts by authoritarian states against its country. Now, suffice to say, these kinds of breaches are a serious problem, especially when Kyiv partially blames leaks for failures of the counteroffensive last year on leaks. One wonders whether the failure of Western capitals, not just Berlin, to acknowledge the degree to which Moscow views itself as engaged in an existential war against the West is partly to blame for these lapses, as security would presumably, one hopes at least, be much higher if nations actually saw themselves as at war. So that being the case, I think this is a story we will be returning to, David. It has big ramifications.
Well, thank you very much, Dom and Francis, for your reporting there. Fabrice, wonderful to have you on the show. Thank you so much for joining us. Would you like to start just by introducing yourself to our listeners?
So as you said, my name is Fabrice Desprez. I'm a French journalist and correspondent here in Kyiv, Ukraine. I've been a correspondent in Ukraine for a few years now. For 3 years before the Russian invasion started, I was already working here in Kyiv, so I covered, you know, Zelensky's election and the war in Donbass before it became the full-scale invasion of Ukraine. Now I'm covering the war, essentially all the developments happening here in the country for various publications, including French newspaper Lacroix.
Well, Fabrice, let's start with the war in the East then. I know that you recently wrote up your take on what's happening for the Financial Times. Dom earlier gave us his sort of up-to-date on-the-ground assessment of where we are. So can I ask you, what do you think is happening in the East? Who have you been speaking to? What would you want our listeners to know and understand?
So, you know, I think Dom gave a very good recap of the general situation. You know, what's happening in the East right now is that, of course, Russian forces are pushing very hard. I think the consensus among pretty much everyone, from just your normal soldiers in the trenches to analysts and, you know, senior commanders here in Kyiv, is that the Russians are trying to take advantage of the perceived windows before, you know, the U.S. weapons and the U.S. ammunition finally gets into Ukraine hands, and that they are trying to exploit this window and try to make as much gain as possible. And they have been making some gains, and that they are trying to exploit this window and try to make as much gain as possible. And they have been making some gains, as Dom said, particularly the southern part of Donbass in the Ocheretnye area. They've also progressed in the past month near Bakhmut and Chasiv-Yar. Bakhmut is just about, you know, 6-7 kilometers east of Chasiv-Yar. So for pretty much a year, they hadn't at all from Bakhmut to Chasiv-Yar, and then the past 2 months, they actually managed to come closer, you know, taking advantage of lack of artillery shells, lack of entire defense. Ukraine position have been pounded by those gliding bombs, but also by those close air support Su-25 planes, which have been taking advantage of the lack of air defense. So Russian forces have been making progress and is now closing in on Chasiv-Yar. They haven't entered city yet. They are fighting on the outskirts. They're trying to seize villages on the outskirts of the town, which, as Dom said, is located on a high ground and is one of the last high ground before reaching very important places like Konstantinivka or much further to the north, but the Kramatorsk, which is the actual capital of Ukrainian-controlled Donbass, which is I think a key strategic objective compared to, you know, last year. The battle for Bakhmut had become extremely important, but had become important for sort of strategic reasons, for sort of symbolic reasons, and because Ukraine was trying to fight a battle competition there. Chesed Yad is important in itself for its location. Well, I've been told that it's sort of center of gravity for the Ukrainian defense in the area.
There's so much to get into there, Fabrice. Can I just pick you up on the thing you said there? That, I mean, it's one line from your report for the FT that I drew out, that quote, that Chasiv Yar is the centre of gravity for the Ukrainian defence. Could you potentially go into a little bit more detail? What exactly does that mean? Why is it the centre of gravity? Why is it so strategically important?
So I think essentially it is strategically important because if Ukraine loses Chasiv Yar, it will allow Russian forces to move closer to Konstantinivka. Now, Konstantinivka is a bigger city than Chasiv Yar. It is not on a high ground like Chasiv Yar, so it would likely be easier to take. But more importantly, even without taking this city of Konstantinivka, Russia could simply reach the edge of the city, put it under artillery fire, which would cut first a crucial supply line, which goes from Kramatorsk to Gostinska, and then goes to the Ukrainian defense line near Toretsk. And that is an important defense line, first because it's nowadays it is the last Ukraine defensive line that has not moved since February 2022. So this is a defensive line that has been in place since pretty much 2015. And now with Russian forces moving south near Ocheretnye, if they were also moving toward Konstantinivka, there would be a risk of this defensive line near Toretsk could be surrounded. Even without being surrounded, if Russian forces go near Konstantinivka, they would make supplying those defenders near Toretsk, that would make that task much more difficult. And in a more general way, it would also simply give more options to Russian forces. They could either decide to go south toward that defensive line in Toretsk, they could decide to push towards Kramatorsk, which is, again, a key strategic objective for Russia's general objective of capturing the full Donetsk and Luhansk Oblast. And taking Kramatorsk would probably be the last piece of the puzzle in that plan. They could also move further west. And that fact that it would give them several options on how to proceed would obviously make defense much, much more difficult for Ukraine because they would have to deal with several possible situations. And on top of that, they would have to deal with that in positions that have only been fortified recently and are not as strongly fortified as were those positions that were held since 2016. So all that put together, it would weaken Ukraine defense in the Donbas region considerably.
Fabrice, thank you so much for that. Can we talk a little bit about mobilization and manpower? As we've spoken about on this podcast, obviously many times, manpower is one of the big problems Ukraine faces. What are you hearing from soldiers, officials? How serious is this problem? And also, I mean, a linked question is, even if everything goes right and they start to be able to recruit the number of people and the quality of people they want, how far away is this from being solved?
You know, of course, there are lots of issues surrounding mobilization. Right now, one issue that I think you touch on here is that there is an issue of timing. The assumption, again, among pretty much everyone, is that so far Ukraine government hasn't tackled this issue hard enough, hasn't been mobilizing enough people. And the problem, of course, here is that you have an issue of timing, right? If you start mobilizing en masse right now, then there are still at least 2 months before those people, those units can be combat effective, which is also something that Russia is aware of, which is also part of that sort of window of opportunity for Russia in the coming week. So again, this is something that really comes up in pretty much every conversation, from really simple soldiers to Ukraine officials, to top officials and analysts. You're going to hear, the simple soldiers saying that their units are just understaffed and that they themselves are absolutely exhausted, because that's sort of the reverse side of the medal, because Ukraine units don't have enough people. Those people that are there simply cannot rest, cannot be rotated out. This is something that was said extremely clearly by Yuri Sodol, who is the commander of the Khortyzytsia grouping of force in the east, so dealing with the big part of the hardest part of the front line right now, who said in front of parliament that right now many squad units, squad infantry units only had 2 to 4 people, whereas they should have 8 to 10 people, which means that brigade that should be able to deal with 15 kilometers of front line are only able to defend 5 kilometers of front line, which means that the Ukraine military has to deploy 2 additional brigades in order to deal with that same stretch of front line, which means that those 2 additional brigades cannot rest, cannot train, cannot go on the offensive somewhere else. Another thing I was told by a company commander of a brigade currently in the East is that Ukraine right now doesn't have the strength to counterattack, which means that Russian forces can actually plan the offensive without really being afraid of Ukraine forces attacking them before they attack. So they sort of have this peace of mind, quote unquote, to prepare and plan the offensive at a tactical level, and they don't really fear Ukraine counterattack, which is also a big issue. So there is a whole host of issues, and it's clearly right now in pretty much every discussion, it's the thing that comes up again and again.
Fabrice, you mentioned in your first answer that Ukrainian troops are obviously waiting for the Western ammunition, the US aid bill, which provided that, to make its way to the front, to give them the ammunition they need. What kind of difference do you think that will make? Do you think it will, on the one hand, enable them to stop the Russian advance? Will it give them potentially that capacity to counterattack? Or do we not really have a sense of the difference it could make? What's your thinking here?
I'm not sure myself, to be honest. What I've heard, what I've been told, that I mentioned a company commander of a brigade in the East who told me it's going to help stabilize things, but not much beyond that. That would take on things. And again, it came back to the issue of manpower. Yeah, stabilization was the stake. I think the general feeling right now is that Ukraine is facing a huge shortage of artillery ammunition, of entire defense ammunition, and of people. And that U.S. support is going to help plug that gap when it comes to artillery ammunition and entire defense. But that's going to leave the issue of manpower. And on that front, there is still no indication that Ukraine is plugging that gap. And on the contrary, there is some data that, especially in the eastern front line, that gap is actually climbing, that Russia is bringing more and more forces, whereas Ukraine forces are more and more exhausted, and you also have now sort of stronger gap between the strongest and the less strong units, where the more elite units are also deployed constantly. Used, there was a term that I've been told was, I use that, firefighters, so I deploy it pretty much every time there is a hot situation on the front line. So they get exhausted, and that's when you have those cracks on the front line, which is what happened in Cheretnyi, when Russian forces were able to advance 5 or 6 kilometers in just a few days, that they were facing exhausted and undermanned units.
Fabrice, thanks so much for your time today. I think you've articulated very well the strategic significance of Chasiv Yar. Just wanted to ask what your assessment was, speaking to people on the ground, of the chances, which may indeed be very slim, but the chances of, if Chasiv Yar, or maybe when Chasiv Yar falls to Russia, the chances of a breakout, as it were, or a breakthrough from Russian forces. Will we see the possibility of that, and actually maybe there being quite substantial gains if Chasiv Yar falls? Or do you anticipate that Ukraine, as it were, will, as it has been up until now, just move to the next settlement and defend that for as long as it possibly can? I'm just interested in your perspective on that, because of course there were so many pessimistic assessments that talked about the possibility of a Russian breakout and breakthrough, but interested to get your sense on the ground of what the strategy would be if, when Chasiv Yar falls.
Thanks, Francis. So I'll put the big caveat here that I'm obviously not a military expert, but, you know, from what I've heard, from what I've seen, from what I've been told, I know the fear of a breakthrough has been mentioned. This is not something that seems completely impossible. At the same time, I mentioned Konstantinivka, which is also a major city. It is still, I think, about 40 kilometers south of Kramatorsk. And I think what we've seen right now, especially in the areas of Cheretnyi, is that Russian forces are actually pretty cautious. They are not trying to make any big, big breakthrough. We've seen, you know, advance in Cheretnyi, and then they started working on widening the salient that they had created. So it seems to me that the strategy is more to continue to advance slowly and surely rather than to attempt a very big breakthrough, you know, that could potentially be counterattacked. That's how I see things. I think we're going to keep seeing this sort of gritty kind of war with slow Russian advances, at least for the coming weeks. Breakthrough, you know, actual breakthrough is not impossible, unfortunately. But in the short term, it's not what I would expect.
Fabrice, hi, Dom here. Great to chat to you again. Bonjour, mon brof. I'm sorry about it. You've gone all the way to Kyiv, and I'm going to ask you a domestic French question, if I may. Hoping you're still tapping into what's going on back home. I note that Monsieur Macron is hosting Xi Jinping at the moment, a two-day summit. I think today is day two of the two-day summit. He's taking President Eleven down to the Pyrenees to show him where Mr. Macron's parents were, where he was born, all this kind of stuff. He's trying to do the old sort of stroking ears, towel flicking level of diplomacy, just to make friends and all the rest of it. Now, Mr. Macron was accused of being a useful idiot in his early attitude towards Putin, and he's copped a bit of flack as well for trying. Well, not trying the same thing, but extending the hand of friendship. I'm not saying it's the wrong thing to do to President Xi, and sort of a light touch. Ooh, mate, can you have a word about Ukraine and climate change and all the rest of it? Others, people are saying it should be very much the other way around. What's your view, and how's this going down domestically in the French press and public? President Macron's hosting of President Xi at the moment.
Excellent question. I actually wouldn't be surprised if you knew more about this than me. What I can tell you is that Xi Jinping visit is a very big deal, and Ukraine has been part of the agenda. I'm not exactly sure, and I don't think that French diplomacy has any hope of this leading to any sort of breakthrough. Maybe long-term investment, something that could bear some fruits in the future, big maybe. Now Macron sort of keep going into, you know, he's had a big change in recent months, say in the recent year even. This is
even on a budget, quality is non-negotiable. That's why Quince is the place to score high-end essentials at 50 to 80% less than similar brands. Get your hands on buttery soft cashmere sweaters from just $60, Italian leather jackets, and so much more. And the best part about Quince, they exclusively partner with factories committed to safe, ethical, and responsible manufacturing. Elevate your style without the elevated price tag with Quince. Go to quince.com/upgrade for free shipping and 365-day returns.
Ever catch yourself eating the same flavorless dinner 3 days in a row? Dreaming of something better? Well, HelloFresh is your guilt-free dream come true, baby. It's me, Keke Palmer. Let's wake up those taste buds with hot, juicy pecan-crusted chicken or garlic butter shrimp scampi. Hello Fresh. Stop dreaming of all the delicious possibilities and dig in at HelloFresh.com. Let's get this dinner party started.
Something that I've heard now many times in Ukraine is the suggestion that maybe France could, you know, deploy a troop in Ukraine at some point has been very welcomed in Ukraine, but also accompanied with some bafflement. There is still some lack of understanding of Macron's trajectory, which is understandable, I think. Now I think he's well set on that trajectory. I'm not sure that for him, Ukraine has been the number one topic. It has been mentioned, obviously, but with no expectation of any quick breakthrough.
Well, thank you very much, Dom and Francis, for your questions. Fabrice, thank you for answering all of us so eloquently. Two final questions from me. One is maybe an easy and a quick question, really, but what's your sense of how the French press is covering the war in Ukraine? Is there still a huge amount of interest? Is it still on the front pages every day? Are there lots of other French foreign correspondents like yourself in Kyiv? What are you seeing?
So there is still definitely interest. I will say that, you know, it goes through cycles, right? Right now, clearly, there is less interest. There was, for example, February. Now there is lower, but pretty constant interest. There are now, I'm not sure how many full-time French correspondents in Kyiv there are now, but there are a handful of us. was still publishing regularly. I still, you know, get requests for stories on the situation in Ukraine pretty regularly. It's sort of now, I would say, got into, unfortunately, a kind of routine until something big happens. I feel like sort of in between currently.
And finally, Fabrice, is there anything we haven't spoken about that you think is important to mention or important for our listeners to hear and understand from you?
I would say the only thing that I would like at least to emphasize is really this perception right now in Ukraine that May is going to be this very difficult month. You know, we've talked a lot about the military situation, but I think it's also interesting that there is also some anxiety surrounding the political situation, surrounding the fact that on May 20th would have been this time when President Volodymyr Zelensky's mandate would have ended. Right now, of course, because of the martial law, his mandate will not end. There is a very, very broad expectation that Russia is going to try to use that in order to try and paint Volodymyr Zelensky as a sort of illegitimate leader. And, you know, even inside Ukraine parliament, there has been for a few weeks, a few months right now, some arguments on this issue on how, you know, Ukraine should be led forward. So there is sort of this fear that Russia could try to use that article in this May, combined with the military situation. So it's clearly a difficult time for Ukraine. And at the same time, as I said, there is not the expectation or at least the hope that this massive US aid package is going to help stabilize the situation.
Coming up, we hear Dom, Francis, and Fabrice's final thoughts. Dom, would you like to go first with your final thoughts? Dom Nichols.
Thanks, David. Final thought slash update. Just in the last hour, I've been scrambling to get more information on this news that was breaking as we came on air, so I didn't do it earlier on in the news. But from what I can tell, Ukraine has detained two security officials over a plot to assassinate President Zelensky, among others. Ukraine's security service, the SBU, put an announcement out on social media saying that counterintelligence and SBU investigators have disrupted the FSB, that's the Russian FSB's, plans to eliminate the president of Ukraine and other representatives of the highest military and political leadership of the state. Now, two colonels in the State Guard of Ukraine, they protect top officials, have been detained under suspicion of treason, which carries a life sentence. The SBU say that these men were part of a network run by the FSB. They were recruited before the start of the full-scale invasion, and this attack, or these attacks, were planned to be conducted or carried out ahead of Putin's inauguration today. You'll remember President Zelensky said in 2022, which feels a long time ago now, that he had been the subject of at least 10 attempts on his life. Vasyl Malyuk, the SBU chief, who was one of the other officials targeted alongside Kirill Badanov, the head of Ukraine's military intelligence agency. Mr. Malyuk said that these attacks were supposed to be an inauguration present for Putin. But that's breaking the last hour. There'll be more news on that over in the next few hours, I imagine. But that's it. That's us up to date. Bang up to date now, David.
Thank you very much, Dom and Francis. Fabrice, as our guest, would you like the very final words for today?
Thanks, David, and great to hear from Fabrice. Stay safe out there. One thing that Fabrice said, actually, which I just wanted to comment on, is he talked about the fact that President Zelensky has now formally gone past when the election would have been, and therefore, in the eyes of Russia, they can use this now as a means of attacking and critiquing President Zelensky's legitimacy. And I think we should expect to be seeing and hearing a lot more from that in the coming weeks and months. It will be an attack line, almost certainly. And I think there are already signs that that will be something the Kremlin will seek to use to try and weaken Western support for Zelensky, despite the fact, of course, that under Ukraine's martial law, it is entirely legal for there not to be the election because of course, the dangers for the Ukrainian population of having an election, not least the kind of missile strikes there would be on major cities in if there were an attempt to have a nationwide election. So just I wanted to flag that because I think Fabrice is absolutely right. In terms of my final thought proper, I quoted from that long read in the Washington Post earlier, one of the newspapers who's done some of the best Western reporting on the conflict since it began 2 years ago. One of their columnists, of course, is jailed Russian journalist and opposition figure Vladimir Kara-Murza, whose wife we interviewed back on day 649. We'll add a link in the description. Well, he's just won a Pulitzer Prize, the highest award for achievements in newspaper, magazine, online literature and musical composition produced for outlets in the United States. It's for the commentary he's done writing from his prison cell. The judges noted his passionate columns written under great personal risk, warning of the consequences of dissent in Putin's Russia and insisting on a democratic future for his country. And I think to receive it on the same day as Putin's inauguration feels symbolic, for this is a man who represents a very different vision of Russia's future and who chose to go back and face imprisonment to draw attention to the fact that not all Russians support Putin and his cronies. He is one man, yes, but no change can ever occur in history without such brave people willing to put their life on the line for the vision of a better future. So if listeners haven't read his fascinating pieces from his cell, I highly recommend them.
Thank you very much, Dom and Francis. Fabrice, as our guest, would you like the very final words for today?
Thank you very much for having me. It's been a pleasure to talk about pretty much everything that's going on. And there is a lot of things going on in Ukraine right now. It feels like right now a very intense moment with a lot of anxiety for the very immediate future, the coming weeks. We haven't even really talked about strikes, energy infrastructure, which Russia has been doing those past few months, which has actually been putting the Ukrainian energy system in pretty bad situation. So there are lots of things, but I really appreciate you having me here. Hope to do that again. Thank you again.
Ukraine the Latest is an original podcast from The Telegraph. To stay on top of all of our Ukraine news, analysis, and dispatches from the ground, subscribe to The Telegraph. You can get your first 3 months for just £1 at www.telegraph.co.uk/Ukraine the Latest. Or sign up to Dispatches, our Ukraine newsletter, which brings stories from our award-winning foreign correspondents straight to your inbox. We also have a Ukraine live blog on our website where you can follow updates as they come in throughout the day, including insights from regular contributors to this podcast. You can listen to this conversation live at 1 p.m. each weekday on Twitter Spaces. Follow The Telegraph on Twitter so you don't miss it. To our listeners on YouTube, please note that due to issues beyond our control, there is sometimes a delay between broadcast and upload. So if you want to hear Ukraine the Latest as soon as it is released, do refer to podcast apps. If you enjoyed this podcast, please consider following Ukraine the Latest on your preferred podcast app. And if you have a moment, leave a review as it helps others find the show. You can also get in touch directly to ask questions or give comments by emailing ukrainepod@telegraph.co.uk. We do read every message. And you can contact us directly on Twitter. You can find our Twitter handles in the description for this episode. Ukraine the Latest is produced by Louisa Wells and Giles Gear.
Hey, it's Danny Pellegrino from Everything Iconic. Ready to upgrade your style game without blowing your budget? Check out Quince. They've got all the good stuff, shirts and polos, activewear and fine leather goods, all at 50 to 80% less than other high-end brands. And the best part? They're all about safe, ethical and responsible manufacturing. Get that luxury vibe without the luxury price tag. Hit up quince.com/upgrade for free shipping and 365-day returns on your next order. That's quince.com/upgrade.
Hold up. What was that? Boring. No flavor. That was as bad as those leftovers you ate all week. Keke Palmer here, and it's time to say hello to something fresh and guilt-free. HelloFresh. Jazz up dinner with pecan-crusted chicken or garlic butter shrimp scampi. Now that's music to my mouth. HelloFresh.
Fresh. Let's get this dinner party started. Discover all the delicious possibilities at HelloFresh.com.